In the autumn of 1934, Virginia Woolf visited William Butler Yeats in a meeting of literary giants. Woolf noted in her diary that he believes entirely in horoscopes, will not do business with anyone without having their horoscopes. Woolf was uninterested in astrology, whereas Yeats was a lifelong devotee of the round art. He had learned astrology as a young man immersed in metaphysics, first with the Theosophical Society and then from 1890 with the Order of the Golden Dawn, a magical society whose membership included other literary figures such as A.E. Waite, Arthur Machen and Bram Stoker. Yeats' so-called occult interests remain central to his life and his writing, though you may not glean as much from the biographies and academic studies, which concentrate on his activities as a man of letters, playwright and Irish statesman. Yeats' the Magus has come into sharper focus through biographies sympathetic to, or at least intrigued by, his esoteric interests. Among those bothered by Yeats' occultism were T.S. Eliot, Stephen Spender and W.H. Auden, who spoke for many when he asked, "How on earth, we wonder, could a man of Yeats's gifts take such nonsense seriously?" Auden's question can be as easily turned round. If a man of Yeats's gifts took such nonsense seriously, maybe it's interesting. Yeats' esoteric explorations were extensive, entwining Celtic and Greek myth, Indian religion and spiritualism. He often attended seances. In addition to which, the Golden Dawn's first grade teachings included visualization, contemplation, meditation, tarot and astrology. The requirements for first-year students include the ability to raise a horary horoscope and to read it. Further astrological training was voluntary. Other requirements included students to make and paint their own tarot deck in accordance with Golden Dawn designs, and all of these provided much-prized sources of imagery and symbolism for Yeats's poetry, and a way to articulate what he thought was the invisible realm that lay beyond surface reality. William Blake figured large among Yeats's poetic influences. He edited an edition of Blake in 1896, when Blake was deeply unfashionable, just as Yeats was to be an inspirational figure for another astrological poet, Ted Hughes. Yeats may have taken up astrology even before he joined the Golden Dawn, and he remained a lifelong devotee, assiduously following the transits and progressions of his horoscope. Like many astrologers, he found the mechanics of calculation tedious, and, for example, he had his primary directions and secondary progressions drawn up for the next 10 years. Yeats' astrological interests are there in his poems, but they were above all practical and predictive. He wanted to know the most auspicious times for his undertakings. The earliest horoscope we have for him: he was born in Dublin on 13th of June 1865 at 10:15 GMT. It's from 1893 and was drawn up by his uncle George Pollexfen, who also joined the Golden Dawn. Yeats himself and later his wife Georgie Hyde Lees both drew up Yeats' chart. He has an Aquarius ascendant and Aquarius moon to go with his Gemini sun. The chart has other several striking features: a Jupiter-Sun opposition and a Venus-Mars square. This last aspect was a source of vexation to Yeats. The clash of the two personal planets of romance and sex being a poor omen for successful relationships. One that could menace the affectional life, as Georgie Hyde Lees put it later. Yeats, a virgin until he was 30, was racked by sexual uncertainty, and his close relationships with women were intense and difficult. It was this particular aspect in his birth map that helped finally propel Yeats into marriage in the autumn of 1917. He was, as his biographer Brenda Maddox has noted, meeting an astrological deadline. Yeats had known for many years that his progressed son would reach his natal Mars in the seventh house of marriage at this time. He went through the year in a state of emotional turmoil, torn between his unrequited love for Iseult Gonne, the daughter of his greatest love, Maud Gonne, and the willing Georgie Hyde Lees. The last, like Iseult Gonne, a much younger woman, was also a member of the Golden Dawn, and a more skilled astrologer than Yeats. Like Hughes after him, Yeats noted the overlaps between his own birth chart and his wife's, and seems to have chosen an astrologically propitious day on which to get married. From the outset, the marriage of William and George, as she liked to be called, was based as much on their overlapping esoteric interests as on any mutual physical desire. Within days of the marriage, they had embarked on the experiments in automatic writing that would hold Yeats spellbound for years, and would culminate in a vision, an exposition of Yeats' personal cosmology and philosophy. The book was published in 1926, and again much revised in 1937. It's a cryptic, complex work, which tries to correlate the mysteries of incarnation according to phases of the moon. As such, it has a clearly astrological perspective, but the 28 mansions of the moon which it describes are not given by the moon's phase at birth, being instead stages in the soul's evolutionary path through incarnation. One's present life might be, say, in phase 23, the receptive man, or in phase 10, the image breaker. Yeats and Hyde Lees often discuss the people they met in this way. Astrological influences come to the surfaces in Yeats' work most forcefully in the most famous of all his poems, The Second Coming, which was written around 1919 in the midst of George Hyde Lees' channeled outpourings. Part of the poem goes like this: "But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born." That so many meanings have been read into the poem is a mark of its greatness. Clearly one of its mainsprings is the concept of the great year, the complete precession of the equinoxes, of which one month is, for convenience sake, 20 centuries. Like any theosophist astrologer, Yeats knew all about the new age that was supplanting the age of Pisces, which had in turn supplanted the age of Aries at the birth of Christ. Hence, the image of the rocking cradle. Brenda Maddox cannily points out that Yeats and his wife were expecting their first child at the time the poem was written, and suggests the couple considered that their own child might be the Maitreya, the world teacher, the role for which Jiddu Krishnamurti was being unsuccessfully groomed by the theosophists. What sort of new age was Yeats describing here? The poem rings with millennial expectation, and the rough beast carries an echo of Revelation's beast of the apocalypse. Yeats was living in turbulent times, in the aftermath of the First World War, and the Russian Revolution, and amid ongoing turmoil in Ireland, yet he may not have been describing apocalypse and the collapse of civilization, but the birth of the much-expected New Age, what theosophical astrologers were beginning to describe as the Age of Aquarius. Astrological imagery appears elsewhere in Yeats' poetry, say in his depressed lyric Under Saturn, or a couplet such as "When Jupiter and Saturn meet, oh, what a lot of mummy wheat." This is playful mythology. The 20-year conjunctions of Jupiter and Saturn, suggest Yeats, bring plenty with them. Such was the manner of Yeats' cross-cultural symbolic thinking and its enriching effect on English poetry.